Now, we begin first by tracing the progression of Reformed Orthodoxy in more of a systematic form through church history and all of this. And William Klemper, in The Concept of the Covenant, page 96, notes that Augustine and Irenaeus are really the only two early fathers who utilized the covenant to a great extent in their writing. Now, this doesn't mean that the other early fathers didn't mention the covenant or didn't utilize ideas concerning the covenant, that it would be incorrect. But it's not surprising to see the Reformers and the Puritans heavily quoting Augustine in their writings. Irenaeus himself taught four covenants that God made with men. And we can look through the history of the church and see some of those covenants still utilized. But Irenaeus was correct in talking about the expressions of the covenant in the Adamic, Noahic, Mosaic, and the covenant under Jesus Christ. We're going to see how we expand that a bit. Gabriel Biel, in the 15th century, made use of the idea of covenant in the relationship of justification. The progression continued through the 15th century, where various theologians argued for the reality of the eternal covenant, or the covenant of redemption, to be later termed. Wolfgang Capito, in 1478 to 1541, made use of the covenant all through his commentary work on the Bible. And then came Ulrich Zwingli, who defended the covenant against the Anabaptists. With Heinrich Bullinger, 1504 to 1575, the covenant concept began to take a more systematic shape and form. Bullinger defined God's covenant as, quote, "God, in the making of leagues, as he doth in all things else, applieth himself to our capacities, and imitateth the order which men use in making confederacies. And therefore, when God's mind was to declare the favor and goodwill that he bare to all mankind, it pleased him to make a league or covenant with mankind." Now, Calvin then picks up the reins in his institutes. And his institutes are smothered in these covenant concepts. Others wrote extensively on the covenants. Wolfgang Musculus in 1497 to 1563, Martin Bucer 1491 to 1551, Peter Martyr 1499 to 1562, Andrew Hyperius 1511 to 1564. But in peak form, the covenant concepts came out in the Heidelberg Catechism, written by Caspar Olivianus and Zacharias Ursinus, 1534 to 1583. Here we find the recognized principle of really a single covenant of grace running through all of redemptive history. Expressions of that covenant appear in the Noahic, Mosaic, and so on, as we'll find out. Even William Tyndale, in 1494 to 1536, utilized the interpretive principle of covenant as a hermeneutic for understanding all of Scripture. And you can go study all of those men, if you'd like, and read their writings and take a look at what they say. Find out that covenant concepts are important. God speaks by way of covenant all through the Bible. Israel is his covenant people. The covenant was defined by the Reformers, but it was expanded and it was detailed by the Puritans and Dutch theologians of the time. Dudley Fenner, William Perkins, Robert Rollick, John Preston, William Ames, John Owen, Richard Baxter, the Westminster Standards, they all portray a paedo-baptistic, covenantal, federal theology in fine detail. However, in a cogent and detailed form, there is no better outline of this system than in Cocceius' pupil, Herman Witsius. Now, Witsius wrote a book called The Economy of the Covenants Between God and Man, and it's considered a pinnacle work for both Britain and America after its publication. You can still go out onto the internet. You can still go to Cumberland Valley Bible Book Service. It's www.cvbbs.com, and you can order Witsius's The Economy of the Covenants Between God and Man, and I would suggest you do so. It's a very helpful book. It is considered a standard textbook for Reformed theology, for covenant theology, which included infant inclusion in the New Testament covenant. So in denying the basic tenets of what inclusion of the covenant means, and this treads upon the meaning of the sacrament, not the ordinance, the sacrament, ultimately proving a discontinuity or a wall between the Old Testament and the New Testament, to the extent that some form of dispensational thought cannot be avoided. It's actually created by doing this, even unknowingly, by those who reject the continued inclusion of infants in the covenant or of Reformed covenant theology. Now, covenant or Reformation theology teaches that the sacraments are designated in a twofold manner. And we're going to talk about this more in-depthly in the second session, but they talk about them as signs and seals. I do want to touch upon this now, because when you deny a central aspect of Reformed theology, you're not holding to Reformed theology anymore. You've created some aberration, some deviancy to it. A unique variation or difference of the Reformed tradition over and above any other system of doctrine is sacramental theology. The sacraments of the Lord's Supper and of baptism stand out in a very different manner in Reformed orthodoxy than they do in any other system of thought, be it Roman Catholic, Anabaptist, Baptist, or even in the order of Zwingli. And it might even be important to note that in this area of doctrine, Zwingli seemed to have taken a rather lax view of the manner in which the sacraments minister to us by faith, and the manner in which Christ ministers to his people in the act of taking the bread and the wine, especially concerning the Lord's Supper. Having been exposed to variations in theological perspective over the last 16 years of my life, I've seen a great difference in the manner that each theological system differs with Reformed theology in the way that the sacraments are utilized and taught in comparison to covenant theology. It is fair to say that many who hold the banner of the Reformed faith do not believe the doctrine expounded by the Reformers on the sacraments. And this is not only true of those like the Reformed Baptist in denying infant inclusion in the sacrament of baptism, which all the Reformers and Puritans labored to expound, but of many Reformed brethren in misunderstanding the Lord's Supper and its impact on the believer. The sacraments themselves are signs and seals of the promises of God working to build up our faith. As Calvin asserts, they are, quote, they're like seals of goodwill that he, God, feels towards us, which by attesting that goodwill to us, sustain, nourish, confirm, and increases our faith. Institutes 4.14.7. Now, this does not mean that the sacraments are magic. But at the same time that they're not magic, they are a ministering sacrament of grace to the believer. G.C. Birkhauer states this succinctly. They, meaning the sacraments, cannot be detached from the power of God and from the working of the Spirit who convinces us in the sacrament. The administration of the sacrament does not fulfill its function with regard to our salvation unless the Spirit as a teacher sends his power. The Spirit, quote, by whose power alone our hearts are penetrated and affections moved and our souls open for the sacraments to enter in. That's Birkhauer in the Sacraments as Signs and Seals, quoting Calvin in his Institutes. Now, it's not enough to say that we have to sit in the pew and meditate on what the Lord has done for us when we take a sacrament of the Lord's Supper. There must be a real and powerful working of the Spirit of God in and through the sacrament as we partake by faith. We can't muster up enough grace ourselves to make the sacrament effectual to ourselves. If we don't do that, strengthening our already tainted understanding of God's grace to us, who would ever say that he can muster up grace to impart grace to himself when we put the piece of bread or drink a little bit of the wine? This then makes the sacraments as useful help to the Christian in that they signify and seal to us grace. And they aren't, as Zwingli would have us believe, simply a memorial and nothing more of outward externalities. That's not what Jesus thought. It's not what Paul taught. The focus is on God's power to signify and to seal in the sacraments to those partaking of the supper or baptism. Yet, many would then reject the Reformed position on the sacrament because it's primarily an act of God and not an act of the person that makes this effectual, especially within the realm of infant baptism. For example, Reformed Baptists believe that infant inclusion in the new covenant is a fallacy. They would never administer the sign and seal of the righteousness of faith to any but those who, by profession, believe in the work of Christ that's wrought in them. However, that position, from a Reformed perspective, is fallacious, since it is the very nature of the sacrament to those in the covenant that makes the weightiness of the act in tune with the seriousness of sin in rejecting the truth of what they're doing. For instance, Esau was circumcised on the eighth day with Jacob. Circumcision is a sign and seal of regeneration, as we're going to find out in the next session. A question would be posed. Did Isaac believe his two children were now in the covenant when he circumcised him? Well, the answer to this is yes. If Isaac then circumcised Esau, and Esau then later rejects his birthright and loses his blessing, though he sought it with tears, and if he counts the covenant as an unholy thing, does this make his sin all the more aggravated based on the manner in which the covenant is administrated? The answer to that is absolutely sure, yes. It's the sign and sealing of the promises of God upon a person that makes both baptism and the Lord's Supper such an ordeal in this manner. It's bound in blessing or bound in judgment. And those partaking of the sacraments, whether baptism or the Lord's Supper, are confronted with the reality that they are signs and seals, as Berkauer states. He says it this way, precisely therein lies the basis of the serious sin of misusing the sacraments. We can't misuse them. We misuse the sacraments, we break covenant with God. Turretin also commends this view as the Reformed view, and speaking of these sacraments as signs and seals, in the same manner, which he believes is following Paul in Romans 4:11. He says, quote, elements are instituted by God in order to signify and seal grace. This is the grace of God in Christ, and Christ with all his benefits. Institutes of Eclectic Theology, Volume 3, page 339. They are instrumental in the ministry of the efficient cause of their power, which is God. They're not only signs, badges of profession for the visible church, but they go deeper than that, as Turretin asserts correctly. They are signs of the covenant and the ratification of the promises made on both sides, on the part of God and the part of men. Yes, there is a ratification. There is something that men must do in response to the covenant. He likens the sealing of the sacrament to the visible and external preaching of the word as well. For instance, when the sign and the seal of the sacrament is taken in the Lord's Supper by a hypocrite, it then does not negate the power or efficacy of the promises contained in the sacrament. It doesn't do that. Just because he's a hypocrite, that doesn't make the power and efficacy of what the sacrament is about null and void. Rather, what happens is that he's judged. It doesn't mean that the power and efficacy is transferred into a person. That's Romanism. That's not what we're talking about. But the reality of it. For those who would take it by faith, it still exists in its objectivity. The Lord's Supper and baptism are not subjective sacraments in their power. They are objective means of grace. Turretin likens them to the ministry of the Word. Some are not converted. Some are converted when the Word or the message of the Gospel goes forth. But just because some people are not converted doesn't mean it goes out in vain. God says that his word never returns to him void. Paul says that we are a savor of death to some and a savor of life to others. In the same manner, the sacraments are filled with the power of judgment for those who partake them in a manner that's not worthy of the glory of God and the ratification of covenant promises. Those such as Esau, the reprobate Israelites, Korah and Achan. Should, then, the sacraments not be given to those who cannot of their own accord believe, like in the case of an infant? Well, not at all, says Turretin. Baptism should be administered as God commands, which, within Reformed orthodoxy, would be to infants of believers, as well as those who profess faith in Christ. The reality of the ratification of the covenant will be seen later. We'll go over that. Whether in judgment or blessing, the terms of covenant promises. Thus, it can be easily seen in short here, just in what we're talking about in brief, that the Reformed take a far different view of the sacraments and their implementation than other theological formulations. The sacraments involve more than just a cognitive aspect which men like Zwingli assigned to the Lord's Supper, though he was quite different in his approach to baptism as a result of infant baptism against the Anabaptists. Now, infants are unable to cognitively deal with the truth surrounding baptism. Does this exclude them from the practice? Well, to understand this, we turn for a moment to see the Reformed idea of the sacrament as a seal, rather than simply a sign signifying something, which is often a one-sided Baptistic position. Both are important, signs and seals, and both are always present in the administration of the sacrament. Thus, we must be exceedingly careful not to separate the sign from the seal. We may speak of each and explain each, but both are vital and necessary to a Reformed position. Even when unbelievers partake of the sacrament, both the sign and the seal of the sacrament are initiated by God's promise in it. Now, careful now. Don't misunderstand this. There is no magic again in the sacrament. But unbelievers, as unbelievers, like gospel hypocrites who were baptized, have the sign of the promise of God on them in the promise of judgment, because they partake in a manner unworthy of the sacrament. They are confronted again with the use of the sacrament for blessing or curse. That's the idea of covenant, and we'll see that. Baptism, or the Lord's Supper, can never be emptied of the power in one manner or another. Men, even gospel hypocrites, are faced with the sign and seal of the triune God placed upon them. Will their fruitfulness in it be of eternal life? Or will they reject it, even being in the midst of the assembly, even partaking of some of the heavenly gifts, tasting of the age to come, being in the midst of that, being in covenant that way, and reject it? Will it be eternal death to them? What is baptism seal? Burkhauer, I think, states this well. One can say unhesitatingly that baptism is a sign and seal of the promise of God, and at the same time that believers are sealed for the day of redemption in their belief, which rests on the promise. End quote. Is the power of God seen in preaching? Of course it is. Is the power of God seen in the sacraments? Of course. Is this all a matter of God's work, or is baptism in the Lord's Supper something we do? Is it a memorial that we feed on simply by stirring up and exciting our own ideas about what Christ has done for us, as most Reformed Baptist churches believe, or is there something more? Jeffrey Bromley, in his article, The Meaning and Scope of Baptism, explains it this way, quote, "We are forced to conclude that baptism is primarily a sign or seal of God's own work. Saying this, however, is simply another way of saying that it's a sign or seal of the covenant and its fulfillment in Jesus Christ. God's reconciling and regenerating work constitutes the fulfillment of the promise that lies at the heart of covenant and of all God's dealings with his covenant people." End quote. The sign and seal of baptism or the Lord's Supper, then, is the sacrament. If seen in the sacrament, and is effective and through the work of Christ upon the soul. That sign and seal of both sacraments is effective in and through the work of Christ upon the soul. Though the power of God is seen in the sacrament, it doesn't mean that he'll always make the promises of the sacrament come to fruition in the manner in which to us would be positive. We see the, quote, positive nature, quote, of the sacraments and the acts surrounding and concerning salvation. But that might not necessarily be the case. Isaac circumcises Esau. Does this mean Esau is going to be regenerate? This seems to demystify the sacraments altogether when the positive nature of the sacraments is rejected that way. And this, in fact, seemed to be the cause of Zwingli's own abandonment of what is called the Reformed view of the sacrament today. Now, it's not the scope of this particular session to fully exhaust the doctrines surrounding sacraments, signs and seals. However, I did mention what has been said due to the need to clarify ideas surrounding Reformed doctrine or those who claim to be Reformed. In summing up the idea that, quote, Reformed in sacramental theology are those faithful to the Reformers and the biblical data they propagated, we can quote a number of different people for summary statements. One gentleman, in an article called The Lord's Supper and the Reformed Confession, he surveys all the Reformed confessions to arrive at a consensus for the material on the Lord's Supper. He surveys Reformed theologians and their ideas concerning the Lord's Supper and gives this correct statement. The conclusion of this survey of the Reformed confessions is plain. The judgment that Calvin's Eucharistic teaching must be regarded as the Orthodox Reformed doctrine oversimplifies the evidence. We're talking about Reformed theology. Systematized Reformed theology. Whenever we look at all of the confessions in the history of the church, all the greatest confessions, they summarize those that are Reformed. They summarize the Reformers' positions. There are certain lines we're able to draw when we deal with Reformed theology. When we dig through the evidence, we know what is Reformed and what is not by a survey of the history of Reformed theology. When dealing with the theology of the Reformers, there are certain aspects that come to the forefront in determining whether a doctrine has come from someone who is Reformed or from a deviant source. We should be exceedingly careful when we begin propagating, quote, Reformed doctrine without knowing what Reformed doctrine is all about. You know, Lord's Supper and baptism as signs and seals is a hallmark of the Reformed faith. Without holding the banner on both of these, we could not call ourselves Reformed. We could call ourselves on the road to being Reformed if we were considering some of those things. But we can't take that in total. Now we might ask, where do we experience Reformed theology today? Reformed theology can be found in many non-Reformed churches. There are many Sovereign Grace Baptist churches that believe in the doctrines surrounding the Synod of Dort and the 5 points exemplifying God's grace over and against the heretical notions of the Arminians. Though they deny Reformed liturgical worship, they still hold the major doctrines on conversion. Though they deny infant baptism and the sealing of the Lord's Supper, they do believe in propagating progressive sanctification and the need for full assurance. We would call them reforming, but not reformed. Some churches deny confessionalism, you know, the use of confession. They believe the Bible and the Bible alone should stand as the church's official confession. However, this seems to be, in and of itself, stretching things a bit too far. For the moment that one of these churches begins defining what they believe, whether they unanimously agree in a church meeting or they write it down on a piece of paper, they're still confessing something universally agreed to by their congregation and church bodies. It becomes confessionalism. And you have to have confessionalism. There's confessionalism all through the Bible. Who do men say that I am? You're the Christ, Son of the living God. That's confessionalism. There are many churches. These churches may be filled with all sorts of Reformation's truth, but still deny many of the major tenets of Reformed orthodoxy, including confessionalism. Now, there are many Reformed Presbyterian churches who are slowly disregarding the confessionalism of their forefathers. In reality, the title of Reformed for them should be stripped away. They are, in a sense, de-reforming, if there ever were such a thing. And we're going to prove, by apostolic sanction, that infants were included in the covenant. We're going to see the text. We're going to exegete the material. We're going to talk about that in the next session. We must be able to prove from the Scriptures what God requires of us in a manner that is coherent and cogent. Unless God has changed Old Testament worship or given us new instructions for worship, fictitious worship is something to be rejected. Now, secondly, after a correct form of worship, we also come to the manner of salvation. Calvin states, quote, "We come now to what we have set down as the second principal branch of Christian doctrine, that is, knowledge of the source from which salvation is to be obtained." He breaks this down into 3 sections. Individual wretchedness, the animation of the renewed man, and then from he says this, quote, "From this stage also he must rise to the third. When instructed in the grace of Christ and in the fruits of his death and resurrection, he rests in him with firm and solid confidence, feeling assured that Christ is so completely his own that he possesses him righteously and with life." Now, in asserting these 2 important areas, Calvin then further breaks down the manner in which these take place. For instance, in salvation, he confirms regeneration, justification by faith, and the doctrine of assurance. Within the realm of worship, he defines a right administration of the Lord's Supper and baptism and the abuses surrounding the ecclesiastical hierarchy of the church. All of these, Calvin saw as of enormous importance. Though he formerly fought against the Roman Catholic abuses of these important and foundational doctrines, the point here to be taken is that these were the foundational important doctrines of the Christian faith. Without a right administration of the sacraments, without a right administration of the gospel, without a right propagation of church discipline, a church gave up its Reformed status. It becomes something other. Even today, without a right administration of the sacraments, without a right administration of the gospel, without a right propagation of church discipline, a church gives up its Reformed status and becomes something other. No doubt, what is given in this session is a very brief summation or summary point of just what Calvin argued in these last couple of points. He certainly went after simony, clerical abuse, the Mass, purified worship, the fruit of doctrine, church discipline, meritorious works, Christ as mediator, and a host of other important areas in contention for reformation. But those suffice. And we should think heavily upon them. The right administration of the sacraments, the right administration of the gospel, and a right propagation of church discipline. A church will give up its reformed status. In conclusion, it should be agreed that being reformed meant something to Luther, Calvin, and their predecessors. Not something we were allowed to take in part in the name of reforming. We must admit that asking Calvin whether or not an abuse of the Lord's Supper is acceptable would be answered by a biblical ferocity. We would not agree that Calvin would accept an abuse of the sign and seal of baptism. He wrote extensively against its abuse in Institutes, Book 4, Chapter 16. We could not agree that Calvin would allow simony in the church. Such aberrations of Reformed doctrines fired up the pen of all of the Reformers and of the pastors of that time. I could not, in good conscience, call myself Reformed, proclaim the Reformed faith if I simply believed one-tenth of what the Reformation thought. I couldn't do that. If I don't believe what they taught, what they thought, how can I call myself Reformed? I couldn't, in good conscience, embrace Reformation doctrine to claim the Reformed banner if I believe nine-tenths of what the Reformation taught. I could say I'm reforming. I could say I'm being reformed. You know, in like manner, I can't believe 4 points of the 5 points of Calvinism and call myself a Calvinist. Those who believe the doctrines of grace know that this little ploy is used far too well by Arminians who say such things. I'm a 4-point Calvinist. I'm a 3-point Calvinist. No. No, you're a confused Arminian. It's much the same with the Reformation. You can't reject Reformed worship, foundational guidelines within the orthodox realm of Reformed doctrine, and say that you're Reformed. You can't discard church discipline and say you're Reformed. You cannot reject covenant theology and call yourself Reformed. You can't misuse the sacraments or deny them and call yourself Reformed. Holding to certain biblical ideologies determines whether or not one is Reformed. And in all of this, you have to ask yourself, are you really Reformed? Now, take a little while. Think through that. Think of that, just that underlying point. What we're talking about is whether or not someone is Reformed. Who is Reformed? What must they hold to? What is Reformation teaching? What is Reformation doctrine? I sit here in the midst of 3,500 volumes of Reformed theology. I have books that are very old. I have books that are new. I have books written by all sorts of different authors. I look around, and I have to ask myself, when I pick up one of those books, is this a volume which purports covenant theology, Reformed theology, Orthodox Reformed theology, in a manner in which is consistent with what that is? When you hear a sermon, when you listen to a teaching or a lecture, you have to ask that question. When we're dealing with what is Reformed theology, we want to have a clear understanding of what it is, because to deny certain aspects of it excludes you from the group. It's exciting when we come to a theological position in the walk that we have before Jesus Christ. Not everybody believes in covenant theology. Not everybody believes in the Reformed systematization of doctrine from the Bible. Not everybody believes that. Is that okay? We're going to find out in the next session that's not okay. And the reason that it's not okay is because when we deal with covenant theology, when we deal with Reformed theology, we're dealing with the manner in which God saves men. When we deviate from that, when we deviate from what the Scripture says, that we're deviating from the way that God has revealed in His Word, the way that He saves men. He does that through covenants. Now, you've probably endured these two tapes, about 2 hours, of talking about what is Reformed theology and are you Reformed really? Now, if you're not Reformed at all, I simply want you to understand that men cannot call themselves Reformed unless they really are. And that's really the point of everything that we've talked about so far. Now, in the next session, we're going to talk about what is covenant theology and trace it right through the Scriptures. We're going to use our Bible. We're not going to quote Edwards and Calvin and Burkhoff. We're not going to go through all of the theologians of the church from Augustine all the way up and through Martin Luther, all through the Pure. We're not going to do that. What we're going to do is we're going to take the Bible and we're going to ask some questions about the Bible from beginning to the end in a very simplistic overview of what covenant theology is about. And hopefully, at the end of that time, you will see the continuity of the covenant that God has made with men in time. You'll see its foundation. You'll see its beginning, even before the foundations of the world. You'll see maybe some things you haven't seen before. But I would ask that you pray through it and listen intently. And hopefully, I'll be able to bring something to you that would be helpful, and that would be edifying. Now, for those of you who would like any more information about what you've heard on these tapes, please go to apuritansmind.com. And I'll get in touch with you and be glad to answer any questions that you might have. May the Lord bless you and keep you.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's E-D-M-O-N-T-O-N, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart, from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, I have not commanded them, whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying his word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew.